Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders. I'm Maria Armudian. In 2001, there were over 40 major and minor groups operating against governments in 28 countries, challenging state authority, often using targeted violence to make political change. Such acts of political violence are not a new phenomenon, but with technological changes, they have grown more sophisticated and more detrimental. The terrorism label has been affixed to these groups. But what exactly is terrorism, and where should it fall on the continuum of political violence? Indeed, government-sponsored violence has killed far more innocent victims than acts of individuals or groups. We're joined now by the foremost expert on terrorism and genocide, USC Professor Richard Dickmedjian. Richard Dickmedjian is an expert in many fields, including the Middle East, political elites, multinational corporations, and, of course, terrorism and genocide. He's authored four books. I think, is it four or is it more than four?
Oh, about eight.
About nine. Eight books.
Yes.
And the latest is called Spectrum of Terror. Welcome, Richard Dickmedjian.
My pleasure.
It's really great to have you here. I want to start with what you did in the preface of this Spectrum of Terror. You said, with the upsurge of violent conflicts in the aftermath of the Cold War, you started to teach this course about terrorism and violence. How much of an upsurge was there?
At the beginning, we thought it was going to be a decline. There was an upsurge specifically because of various national liberation movements had sort of declined, although not totally, but they were replaced by religious violence. And then when the United States began to continue hegemonic policies that as a continuation of the Cold War, except we didn't have the Soviet balance, the Soviet Union wasn't there anymore, there was a response to it. And I think much of the upsurge in Islamic violence, in jihadist violence, is a response to that.
You have taken terrorist acts, individual acts, group acts, and you've actually decided they belong on a continuum with which on the other side belongs state terrorism.
Yes.
Now, what made you decide to create this as a continuum?
Well, the publishing company, actually, of Spectrum of Terror was interested in a conventional book on, in quotes, terrorism, which means in Western parlance and in American parlance, violence against the state. Now, my course that I started teaching in 1991, I believe, it's called Terrorism and Genocide. Now, it looks at the whole spectrum of violence from micro-level violence against the states, the state, to violence by the state. Now, against the state means violence by individuals, such as individual terrorists operating on their own, assassins and so on and so forth. Then groups, subversive, subnational groups, religious, ideological or ethnic, and then violence by the state, human rights violations to all the way to politicide and genocide.
What is politicide? How is that distinct from genocide?
Well, a number of scholars, especially Professor Rummel of the University of Hawaii, came up with that word over 10 years ago. It means genocide for political reasons.
Aren't all genocides sort of...
Well, in a larger sense. But, for example, if you have a rebellion or ethnic violence against the state and the response of the state is genocidal, then that is called politicide.
So what might be some examples that are politicide, but there would be both politicide and genocide?
The one that I deal with specifically is the Kurdish case. The Kurds have been subjected to politicide in at least two countries, specifically Turkey and Iraq. What Saddam did to them was politicide slash genocide. And what the Turks have been doing to them since the Dersim revolt back in 1923-24 under Ataturk and until now is basically that, with the ethnic cleansing. When you destroy 4,000 or 5,000 villages, as they did in the 80s and the 1990s, and where about one-third to one-fourth of Turkey's population are of Kurdish background. And when you get to those magnitudes, you're talking about politicide.
You talk about how the individual and subnational group actions, the actions of violence, are actually almost cyclical with the state actions and that they're interdependent in some ways. Can
Yes.
you talk about that?
Yes. The book uses a modified rational choice model, game theoretic model, which is really a very conservative approach to politics and political analysis.
Now, rational choice is a scholarly term that most of our listeners have not heard. Explain what it is.
Well, rational choice in its game theoretic implication. Think of two antagonists or two negotiators. It's a process of bargaining, and sometimes this process involves the use of force by one side or the other side or both. So it's a violent interaction, let's say. That's why we call it strategic violence. Both sides calculate their each other's intentions and respond to that calculation.
Trying to get the maximum for themselves.
Maximum impact, always dealing in terms of self-interest.
And the idea being that people are, at least to some degree, rational beings. That's why the term rational choice.
That's exactly the problem in traditional rational choice theory. Because traditional rational choice theory, pure rational choice theory, assumes that people are rational because the model is derived from economics. And even in economics, it has been modified. Because in the final analysis, your rational calculations depends on your vision of rationality, which means that you have to perfectly read what the other side intends, which means that you, your culture and your belief system is not a factor, but it is.
Right.
We know that, for
As
example—
is, you mentioned the psychology of a lot of these leaders.
Exactly. Now, if you can explain to me why we went into Iraq in rational terms, you'll fail. Yet I can explain our Iraqi venture or misadventure in terms of the president's psychological predispositions, as well as various other factors, such as various forces within the elite and the electorate pushing him, the neoconservatives, the oil interests, and so on and so forth. Therefore, rational choice theory, strategic violence, interaction, has to be modified to take into account cultural and psychological trends on both sides. I mean, how can you explain suicide terrorism
right.
in pure rational terms?
Right.
You can't.
So let's then connect this back to the idea that these subnational groups and the state and the violence between them is really interactive.
Take the word terrorism, and I have a whole section on terrorism and its various meanings. Terrorists, the word is used to describe the bad guys, the other side. So whoever side you sympathize with, that's
how it's determined. The other side is the terrorist.
Exactly. Now, in a technical sense, some people have tried to apply that word to states as well as individuals. For example, if the terrorists or the terrorist group attacks women, children, and civilians, very often that's called terrorism. And that's the implication that is that that's not legitimate. When a state uses violence, especially a democratic state, uses violence against its citizens, that is state terror, especially if that becomes very heavy violence and the number of people, victims, it's a pattern, in other words. But the other logic, rationale for having this spectrum from the micro level to macro level is, as you pointed out, violence against the state claims far fewer, you know, victims than violence by the state, precisely because the state is so much more powerful. But more importantly, really, for me, insisting to include this notion of violence along a spectrum is precisely because if violence between state and subnational entities is not resolved at the micro level, it very rapidly could escalate toward the macro level. This is why I'm so delighted and I'm so prayerful that the IRA confrontation with Great Britain has been resolved by the use of this consociational method. And even a minister so as violent as Reverend Paisley has seen God, has seen the truth. Because if they're not resolved at that level, then very quickly the state can go into a sense of total pathology where the leadership chooses mass violence, which is politicized and genocide.
Right. And in fact, with all your case studies, what it appears to show in a pattern is that often there's a grievance.
Yes.
By a small group.
Yes.
And the grievance is often a civil right or an oppression, and the grievance is expressed. And when it's not answered in an appropriate way, then it turns to violence.
Exactly. When it's answered with suppression, then the subnational group resorts to micro-level terrorism, and then it escalates back and forth, and eventually it becomes, since the state is so powerful, unless the subservient group can start a successful revolution, and overwhelmingly, in most cases, they can't. So the thing ends up in genocide, whether it's Darfur, whether it's the Armenian case, the Holocaust is the most fascinating example here, because the Jews of Germany, they were so few in number, they did not constitute objectively any threat, political or otherwise, to the Third Reich.
And then Cambodia, you talk about Cambodia as well in here.
Oh, Cambodia. See, much of genocide is driven by pathological elites, pathological leaders. This is why we have to be so careful, even in democracies, in selecting...
Especially in democracies.
In selecting our leaders. Exactly. Well, in democracies, we can do something about it, maybe. But in the Third Reich or in Cambodia, they couldn't do much about it, the poor people, so they were victimized. Pol Pot was a psychologically sick man. Hitler's pathology and the pathology of a number of Nazi leaders has been very well documented. And not to speak about the pathology of the so-called Young Turks, the Ittihad party that did the Armenian genocide.
When you look across all these case studies that you've put in this book, has there ever been an instance where violence has accomplished anything that the perpetrator wanted to accomplish?
No. See, in a violent confrontation, there are only several options. One is one side temporarily subdues the other one, which means that since most people don't turn the other cheek, they respond if they can. This is why Saddam used to destroy not only his enemies, but he used to wipe the whole sub-tribe, the whole clan, because he knew that if anyone lived from that clan, they're going to get back at him. So therefore, unless you can wipe out the other side totally, precisely what Hitler was trying to solve the Jewish question, then some of the people who remember that pain, will try to get back at you. At least remember it.
So violence will always beget violence.
Exactly.
And I think there was only one case in your entire book where it resolved peacefully, and that was with the Irish case.
Irish case. It was resolved peacefully, and here we need to give...
Finally. I mean, there was a lot of violence in
between. Incredible. Yeah, about 3,500, 4,000 people killed over the years. But do remember that it was resolved because very strongly, and here we have to give credit to two leaders who some of us don't like under certain circumstances, Tony Blair and Mr. Clinton. They were the peacemakers, and they came together.
It's interesting because Blair seems to follow whoever is in president office in the U.S.
Yes.
So when Clinton was advocating for peace,
yes,
Blair was along his side. And then when Bush advocates for war, Blair was along his side again.
Exactly. This means that we need to do a psychological profile of Tony Blair. Okay?
He's a follower.
Yeah. Clear cut. But he will go down in history. He will be damned for the Iraqi venture. Yet they will praise him for his success in bringing peace to Northern Ireland.
Well, let's talk about some of these other case studies. You've looked at the Basques, the Tamil Tigers, the Chechens. You've looked at Hezbollah. Is there one that we need to look at the most that you think gives us the best lesson?
Several. Number one, of course, is Hamas. The confrontation between the Palestinians and Israel, that is a very, very dangerous confrontation, not simply in terms of the violence between them, and not simply because of the suicide bombers and so on, but because of the way it feeds the jihadist movement globally and destabilizes the whole region. And that needs to be resolved. Number two is Hezbollah. Hezbollah is not one of your run-of-the-mill terrorist organizations. It's a Lebanese national movement supported by the largest sect in Lebanon, over 40%, plus some Christians, some Sunnis, and others, not simply in Lebanon, but outside Lebanon as well. So the Hezbollah issue is a very explosive issue. You're looking at a second Iraq and a much worse situation because Lebanon is a much more unstable place than Iraq was under Saddam Hussein. This is why we had 15 years of war in Lebanon, plus the first civil war. So I would hope and pray that the Syrian-Lebanese confrontation and whatever the United States has done to destabilize Lebanon and whatever the Israelis have done, all that can be resolved somehow because...
Is there a lesson about how it might be resolvable?
Yes, of course. You have to negotiate and offer each of the parties something. And I've tried to write an op-ed page on Iraq, on how to deal with the powers around Iraq and how to relate those powers as peacemakers internally within a consociational system. See, you have to use the Swiss formula, which has been used in India, which has been used in Lebanon itself. Lebanon would have been fine if its neighbors left it alone.
Its neighbors being?
Well, its neighbors being everybody and his brother. In the old days, not only Syria and Israel, but the United States, the Soviets, the Turks, Saddam, Gaddafi, the Saudis, they all had their own armies and factions. You see, if it's left alone, it will survive.
And we're going to have to end there. We've been speaking to Richard Dekmejian. He's a professor at USC. He's a specialist in the Middle East and multinational corporations and terrorism and genocide. And his latest book is called The Spectrum of Terror. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests. And special thanks to Ankina Aghasian, Melissa Ciprin, who helped produce today's show. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org and click on the audio archives. You can also keep up with us at scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or follow me on Twitter at armudian.